Barack Obama don't get along. I didn't even know they were dating, but... one last thing. There's a movie coming here, for those who are going to be here later in the season, called Five Broken Cameras. It's going to be here on the 24th of July. It says it's an extraordinary... Peter knows about this movie. It's an extraordinary work of both cinematic and political activism. Five Broken Cameras is a deeply personal, first-hand account of nonviolent resistance in Berlin, a West Bank village threatened by encroaching Israeli settlers. So if you're interested in that topic, I'm sure they'll publicize it in the Daily Tribune. So without further ado, I give you Peter Beinart.
Thanks. So I'm going to keep it brief and informal because I really, first I was supposed to do that, but also because I really enjoy the question and answer stuff the most. I should also say, by way of self-promotion, we have a blog at the Daily Beast called Open Zion. You can get to it by going to openzion.com. It's really an experiment in a conversation about Israel that is completely wide open. So we have very right-wing Israelis. Sorry,
no? No, it is.
Okay, so we have very right-wing Israelis. We actually have a piece coming, a piece I think running today by Christians United for Israel. We had a piece by Danny Danone, the Deputy Speaker of Knesset. But we also have pieces by Palestinians who are very harsh criticisms of the State of Israel and everyone in between. And because we really believe that one of the problems in the American Jewish community is we actually don't have a truly open and uninhibited dialogue about these issues, even with people with whom we disagree. And we have a weekly newsletter which kind of sends the best pieces of the week. And if any of you are interested in that, you can sign up for it or send an email to our assistant editor at goldberg@newamerica.net. So please check it out. So let me say a few things about what I think is this really fascinating encounter between Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama. The reason it's fascinating for me, and I write about it some length in my book, is that I think both Obama and Netanyahu have very strong ideas about what Jewishness means. That they actually both have a kind of a Jewish lineage to them. Let me explain what I mean by that. I'll start with, and they are essentially diametrically opposed. Which is to say, the things about Judaism or Jewishness that Barack Obama really admires, Benjamin Netanyahu fears. And vice versa. Let me start with Obama. No American president has spent his adulthood as much in the company of Jews as has Barack Obama. You just think about the environments where Barack Obama spent his life starting in his 20s. Columbia University, Harvard Law School, and then the kind of progressive activist, academic, and political community in Chicago. Obama in the 1980s was a young man with a strong sense of having been born at the wrong time. This was a kind of common sentiment amongst people, young liberals in the 1980s. I remember, because although I'm a bit younger than Obama, I felt this way myself. There was this great sense of having missed out on the excitement of the civil rights movement, of a time of great social change in America, when you were growing up in the Reagan era, where politics was very conservative, and everyone in your generation was supposedly just going to Wall Street. The thing that really defined... Obama had two, I would say, great and interrelated quests in his 20s and into his 30s. The first was, and they were connected, the first was to try to figure out how to be African-American, right? Obama did not grow up around African-American. His father was not African-American. His father was Kenyan. His wife was a white woman from Kansas. He grew up in Hawaii at a fancy private school and in Indonesia. He knew very few African-Americans. Obama decided that he was going to become African-American. Partly, he didn't really have any choice because people looked at him and said, we label you African-American. We're not a country where you get to choose whether you're black or not. People label you. But he decided he wanted to embrace that identity. And one of the ways in which, and I think that's actually really important to understanding his relationship with Reverend Wright. Why did Obama go to Reverend Wright, and Reverend Wright became such an important figure in his life? I think the best way of understanding Obama's relationship with Reverend Wright is through a Jewish concept. It's the concept of Balei Tshuva. many of you are familiar with the concept of Bali Tshuva. Bali Tshuva literally means master of the return. Bali Tshuvas are people, Jews who grow up secular and become very religious. They embrace Judaism. And if you know Bali Tshuvas, the one thing you tend to find about Bali Tshuvas is they tend to look for what they consider to be the most traditional, authentic brands of Judaism. They want what they perceive to be the real thing. And that's why the institutions that essentially attract Bali Tshuvas are organizations like Chabad, Lubavitch, Eshet Torah, or Sameach, in those organizations, or organizations that essentially come out of an ultra-Orthodox perspective. And I think what Obama saw in Reverend Wright's church was a church that was, he saw, very, very authentically African-American. Very authentically rooted in the African-American tradition. And he wanted that. The other way in which he identified his quest for being African-American was the sense that he admired the civil rights movement. That part of what inspired him about being African-American was the experience of the civil rights movement. But politically, he was also very, very interested in how a new civil rights movement could be created. What would be the building blocks of a 1980s version of a civil rights movement that would bring about progressive change in America? He did a lot of reading about the civil rights movement, and he realized very quickly that Jews had been integral in the civil rights movement. Then he came to Chicago. He was brought to Chicago because there were several white community organizers, actually all of them, three of the four of them were Jewish, and these community organizers who were working in the tradition of Saul Alinsky, himself a Jew, were having trouble in the black neighborhoods of Chicago because they were white Jewish guys. So they needed an African American to come. So this itself was a kind of civil rights kind of recreation by Obama at the very beginning with these Jewish community organizers in Chicago in the 80s. Obama also comes to Chicago right in the wake of Harold Washington's mayoral victory in Chicago. So Washington is the first black mayor of Chicago. That's essentially Chicago's version of a civil rights movement, a very bitter racial struggle to get Washington elected. And how is Harold Washington elected? He's elected in large measure of a coalition between African-American votes and Jewish money. I mean, it's really Jews, lakefront, wealthy liberal Jews, who are absolutely critical to the Washington campaign. And when Barack Obama builds his political base in Chicago for his own run, first for state senate, then his failed run for the House, then his run for the Senate, he recreates the Harold Washington Coalition. He goes back to those same people, many of them, most of them, wealthy, progressive Jews. Because let's face it, the wealthy white people in Chicago who are not Jewish are not likely to be that as far to the left. And he recreates a political coalition, which is a significant measure of black-Jewish coalition, which is built on the same lines as the Harold Washington Coalition. And in fact, if you look at his key political mentors and legal mentors, people like Newton Minow, who's the person who gave him his first job when he was a summer intern, where he also met Michelle Obama at Newton Minow's law firm, Abner Mikva, the judge whose clerkship Obama turned down, but who became a very important political mentor, a guy named Judson Minor, who Obama then went to work for many years, as a civil rights attorney before he ran for state senate. All of them were left-leaning Jews who had a connection to Harold Washington. So Obama was essentially assembling his own black Jewish civil rights coalition. The interesting thing about this, and one very significant other figure in this milieu was a guy named Arnold Jacob Wolf, who was the rabbi of the largest synagogue in Hyde Park, which is the neighborhood where Obama lived, which is called KM Isaiah Israel. And Obama actually moved into a house across the street from Wolf. And Wolf was also the rabbi to many of Obama's Jewish friends and mentors. Why is this significant? Arnold Jacob Wolf was the private secretary to Abraham Joshua Heschel. Abraham Joshua Heschel, Abraham Joshua Heschel was the kind of public face of, I would say, of kind of American Judaism in the 20th century, famous for having marched with Martin Luther King, famous for having protested against the Vietnam War. My children happen to go to school named after him. The idea of tikkun olam Judaism, to put it in a very crude way, although Heschel was far, far, far more sophisticated than that. really in many ways comes out of Heschel's example. Wolf, who was the rabbi who was closest to Obama, had been Heschel's private secretary. Himself, in Chicago, did a whole series of quite radical things in support of the civil rights movement and also of African-American efforts in Chicago. And here's where it becomes interesting vis-a-vis Israel. Arnold Jacob Wolf, the rabbi who lived across the street from Barack Obama, was the founding chairman of a group called Bray Rah. How many of you have heard of Bray Rah? Right. Ayn Bray Rah was, the name was taken in response to the Hebrew phrase Ayn Bray Rah, there is no alternative. Bray Rah founded in 1974, says Bray Rah, alternative, there is an alternative. It was the first American Jewish group to support a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. In 1970, it was the first J Street. The founding chairman was Arnold Jacob Wolf, the most significant person in the Jewish milieu that Barack Obama came of age in and built his political coalition around. Bray Rah, he think J Street was controversial. He think I'm controversial. It was nothing compared to what Bray Rah's experience was. Bray Rah had only one national meeting in 1977, and it was physically attacked by the Jewish defense. People actually went in there and knocked over the tables and started attacking people, and it only lasted for 3 years. But Wolf, but not only Wolf, but many of the other Jews who were in that milieu, who Obama came close to, Newton Minow, Abner Mikva, to some degree David Axelrod, Betty Lou Saltzman, who's the woman who organized the rally where Obama gave his famous speech where he sat out against the Iraq War when he was state senator, were all progressive in their politics, to the left in their politics, not only on American stuff, but also very much on Israel. All of them had become essentially alienated, distanced from the American Jewish organizations, some of them during the Lebanon War of the early 1980s, some of them during the First Intifada of the late 1980s. But I think it's very important to understanding Barack Obama, that Barack Obama felt that by the time he started running for president, he had spent an enormous amount of time in the company of Jews. They were overwhelmingly Reform Jews, and they were mostly Jews who were much more J Street than they were AIPAC, in very, very personal ways. And Obama, when Obama started to talk in the presidential campaign about Israel and Jews, what he said was very distinct and interesting. He referred to Heschel repeatedly, and Heschel's idea of the prophetic Jewish tradition of social justice. He talked about having read David Grossman. You know, David Grossman is maybe Israel's most well-known writer, but also someone very, very representative of the Israeli left, a kind of left-wing activist in Israel. And Obama essentially continually referred to the fact that what he admired about Judaism was that Jews were so involved in the civil rights movement, that Jews wrestled with moral issues, that there was this Jewish tradition of social justice. Now, Obama knew that the organized American Jewish community was nervous about him in 2008. They frankly were happier with Hillary Clinton in the primary, who was more of a known commodity. And then they were largely happier with John McCain, who was also more of a known commodity. But Obama won 78% of the Jewish vote in 2008. And I think that Obama interpreted that large Jewish vote for him as confirmation of what his own life experience had taught, which is to say, you know what? Jews are actually liberals, and they are actually fairly liberal in Israel too, which means that they support Israel, but they're not that happy with Israel's policies in the West Bank, and they will back me up if I try to intervene aggressively to try to bring about a peace process between Israel and the Palestinian community. Let me say something about Benjamin Netanyahu to try to show why I think the contrast is so great. Benjamin Netanyahu's father, Benzion Netanyahu, recently died, was the private secretary to Vladimir Jabotinsky. Vladimir Jabotinsky was the leader of the revisionist wing of the Zionist movement. And that's Netanyahu, just as Obama has talked reverently about Heschel, Netanyahu has talked and written a lot very reverently about Jabotinsky, who he clearly believes, after Herzl, was the greatest of all Zionist leaders. There are a couple of interesting things to note about Jabotinsky, which I think help to explain it. The first is, and this is especially important to Jabotinsky's admirers, is that Jabotinsky, more than perhaps any other Zionist leader, saw the Holocaust coming. There is this famous for revisionist, this famous, incredible speech. Jabotinsky was an extraordinary human being. I mean, an extraordinarily talented man. Multilingual, a brilliant writer and orator, and there's this famous speech that he gives to the Jews of Warsaw in 38, and he basically says, in incredibly graphic language, "You don't understand. A massive catastrophe is coming." And also in the United States, the revisionist leaders in the United States were, to their credit, far, far more alarmist about what was happening in Europe than the mainstream labor Zionist leaders, who were more cautious about criticizing Franklin Delano Roosevelt because they felt such a sense of obligation to Franklin Delano Roosevelt for so many things. So one very important thing to understand about Netanyahu is that his two greatest heroes politically are Jabotinsky and Churchill. And what Jabotinsky and Churchill both have in common is the idea that in the 1930s, when so many people were sticking their heads in the sand about Hitler and the Nazi threat, that Churchill and Jabotinsky were voices in the wilderness saying, this calamity is coming. It's going to be worse than you can possibly imagine. And I think it's to understand Netanyahu, it's very important to understand that he sees himself, has always seen himself, in this role as the Jabotinsky-Churchill figure, crying in the wilderness about threats that other people don't want to face in their full horror. Of course, on Iran, this has been very central to him politically in the last few years. But even before that, going back to his earlier political years in the 1990s, he continually, during the peace process of the 1990s, which he was opposed to, he has continually said, don't you understand, the Palestinians and the idea of a Palestinian state are the equivalent of the Nazis. Nobody wants to face this. When Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin signed the Oslo peace agreement in 1993, Netanyahu said to Shimon Peres, who was then foreign minister, you are Neville Chamberlain. You are the appeasement-minded British foreign minister who didn't recognize the threat of Hitler. If you read Netanyahu's big book, published as A Place Among the Nations and republished under the name A Durable Peace, he talks about the idea of a Palestinian state in the West Bank as Sudetenland, right? Sudetenland was the Nazis wanted this chunk of Czechoslovakia, and then once they got it, they weren't satisfied with that, of course. They then took the rest of Czechoslovakia on their way to trying to conquer all of Europe. Very, very important to understand the way Netanyahu's political career, that he has always seen himself as the Churchill-Jabotinsky figure warning about grave, catastrophic threats that others don't want to face. And the other, and I'll end it here, fascinating thing about the revisionist tradition, which you find in Jabotinsky's writings and also in Ben-Sion Netanyahu's writings very, very significantly, and to some degree also in Benjamin Netanyahu's writings as well, is this, a suspicion of the prophets. This is very interesting, right? What did I say about what Obama says he loves about Judaism? The prophetic tradition, that is what Heschel was famous for. Heschel was obsessed with the prophets. Heschel wrote a huge book about the prophets and very much saw himself in the prophetic tradition, you know, truth to power. That what's very interesting about the revisionist tradition is this suspicion of the prophet. Why a suspicion of the prophet? Because in the revisionist telling of Jewish history, the Jewish people were at their best when they were a warrior race. If you look at the way revisionists talk about Jewish history, there is this continual valorization of what Jewish life was like when Jews had kings and generals and armies before they were sent into exile by the destruction of the Second Temple. And the figures that, so for instance, Jabotinsky wrote a biblically based book. Who was the figure that Jabotinsky's novel is based upon? Samson. The figure in Jewish history who Jabotinsky decided to valorize the most was Samson, right? Who was Samson? He was this very, very physical, very, very powerful figure. What you find in Jabotinsky's writing a lot, and also in Father and Son Netanyahu's writing, is the idea that Jews used to be respected for their military prowess, for their ferocity. That the big empires of the day, the Greeks, the Romans, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Egypt, they knew that if you tussled with the Jews, you were going to have a tough time. But then when the Jews got exiled, they didn't have those things anymore. They didn't have an army. They didn't have a military tradition. So they said, well, what can we take pride in? So then the Jews decided, you know what? We're better than that. We don't, that's for the other people. We are in the tradition of the prophets, the people who have a message to spread to the world about higher ethics. And for Jabotinsky, this was very, and Benjamin Netanyahu, very, very dangerous. Why? Because the prophets were always telling you to think about the world as it could be, not the real, harsh, nasty world as it is. And that the problem of the Jews was that the Jews had a tendency to believe that the world was better than it really was. They couldn't see that in the real world, all of these grand, nice ideas about what the world could be like don't actually protect you. And the revisionists saw this as a problem in labor Zionism as well. They said, you know what's the problem with these dominant labor Zionists? They think they're creating in Israel a utopia on earth, a socialist utopia. They're more interested in creating this perfect socialistic world in Israel than they are in simply getting the state and protecting it. And that's that they saw as dangerous. So you find in Netanyahu's writing this consistent tendency to believe that the Jews are too rosy-eyed about their view of the world, that they don't understand that what really matters in the world is power. And that if you are naive about the world, then, in fact, you put yourself in a very, very precarious situation. And it's interesting, what you find in Jabotinsky's writing is a great deal of admiration for the other nationalist movements in Eastern Europe. Ukrainian nationalist movement, the Polish national movement, even the German national movement, although that's pre-Hitler. And why does Netanyahu, a lot of the other Zionists say, we don't like the Ukrainian nationalists, but they're very anti-Semitic, they're very backwards. Netanyahu said, Jabotinsky always said no. They are what we need to be, because they have no illusions about what the world is really like. And I think you can see this tendency in Netanyahu very much as well. For instance, in his response to the Arab Spring, right? Lots of people, when they saw the protests in Tahrir Square, said, oh, isn't this wonderful? Isn't this amazing? The Egyptians are coming out. They want to create a liberal democracy. And Netanyahu said, you're seeing the world as you would like it to be, not as it really is. And to some degree, Netanyahu would say that he's been vindicated by this, by now, the emergence of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so I think from the very beginning, when Netanyahu saw Obama, he saw in Obama, paradoxically, many of the tendencies and traits that he feared about Jews themselves. He said, yes, Obama is one of these guys who loves Jews because he thinks that Jews are better than everybody else, because Jews want to be better than everyone else. And you know what? Trying to be better than everyone else is actually a very, very dangerous thing when you live in a very, very nasty world where a lot of people really hate Jews. And I think that's the kind of, I would say, the intellectual infrastructure. And whether you tend to see it more Obama's way or whether you see it Netanyahu's way, about why there was such a fundamental, I would say, difference in the way they see the world between these two men. So I'll stop there. Happy to talk about that, but also about anything else related to the U.S.
Thank you very much. We're going to have a question and answer period. I want to emphasize you should be asking questions, short declarative questions. And my first question is there any evidence that there's personal animosity between Netanyahu and Obama?
Yes. There is. To be perfectly blunt about it, the clearest indications of that personal animosity were said to me from my book In Context, in which I was prohibited from writing about it. But on both sides, from people who were very much in the room, I don't think there's any question that there's been personal animosity between the two of them. When that personal animosity started, however, I'm not entirely sure. Because I don't think that the two men started out as acrimonious, even though I think they clearly... Netanyahu clearly wanted McCain to win, And Obama clearly would have liked to be Libni to beat Benjamin Netanyahu. No question. I don't think it was personal animosity. The two men met twice before Obama became president. Once at the King David Hotel. Once and in a kind of secret room in at Washington Reagan National Airport. Both sides say that the meetings went well. I actually think at the beginning, what Netanyahu was most worried about, interestingly, was not Obama. It was Hillary Clinton and Rahm Emanuel. One of the important things to understand about the Obama-Netanyahu relationship was there was a lot of bad blood left over from the Clinton years. The Clinton-Netanyahu relationship was a very, very fraught relationship. Let's just go back to it. The history a little bit. Clinton was extremely close to Yitzhak Rabin. Clinton later said that he was as close to no man as he had been to Yitzhak Rabin. When Rabin was assassinated in 1995, and then Shimon Peres became the prime minister and had to run for re-election in 1996, Clinton felt very personally invested in Peres' victory. He sent one of his political consultants over to Israel. He knew Peres wasn't a good politician, to try to help Peres win. Peres lost to who? Benjamin Netanyahu, who beat him in a very, very close vote in a surprise. Then the Clintonites essentially discovered Ehud Barak. I mean, they literally went out looking for a Labour Party leader who would be able to beat Benjamin Netanyahu, who had the military credentials. And in 1999, when Barak ran against Shimon Peres, Clinton sent three political consultants to try to help Barack Obama defeat Benjamin Netanyahu. To help Ed Barak defeat Benjamin Netanyahu. Sorry, that was the test. From the beginning, Netanyahu suspected that Clinton was trying to bring him down. That what Clinton wanted to do was force Netanyahu. Remember, Netanyahu was not a fan of the Oslo peace process. What Netanyahu thought, maybe he'd been right, was that Clinton wanted to force Netanyahu into making steps in the peace process that would basically turn the Israeli right against Netanyahu and create, because Netanyahu had a right-wing coalition, it would create a coalition split that would force the country to go to new elections. And that is what happened. When under enormous U.S. pressure, Netanyahu signed the Wild River Accord, right-wing elements of his cabinet rebelled, and that helped to produce the new elections that Barack won in 1999. There was a remarkable quote by Jill Lockhart, who was one of Clinton's press secretaries after he left office, where he said, quote, "Netanyahu was the most obnoxious individual I ever dealt with in the White House, just a liar and a cheat." Now that, again, part of that animosity is because if Netanyahu thought the Clintonites were trying to bring him down, the Clintonites thought that Netanyahu was trying to bring him down. Remember, Netanyahu during the 1990s also had an American political consultant, a very well-known Republican political consultant named Arthur Finkelstein, who was the political consultant for Al D'Amato and Bob Dole, who ran against Clinton in 1996. And in 1998, January, just after the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, Netanyahu came to Washington, and the night before he met Clinton, he spoke at a rally organized by Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell was one of the people at the forefront of the impeachment effort, which created enormous anger amongst the Clinton people. And when he met Clinton the next day, Clinton turned to him and said, "I know where you were last night." So all of this was the backdrop. This would have been true if Hillary. And so what Netanyahu initially, I think, suspected, this is what people told me from my book, was not so much that he feared that Hillary Clinton is going to be the Secretary of State. That's Clinton's wife. And Rahm Emanuel, who was a very hard-nosed, partisan Democrat, is going to be the Chief of Staff. They're going to poison Obama against me. My chances of ever getting along with Barack Obama are going to be destroyed by the fact that all these Clintonites are going to say, "Oh, we know what he's like. We worked with him. He was terrible." So I think actually initially, I don't think it was really Obama. I actually think that the greater suspicions were of Emanuel and Clinton, and I think that was exacerbated when the Israelis have a pattern politically of trying to find back channels into the White House. And when George Mitchell was appointed, The Netanyahu people tried to create a back channel to Rahm Emanuel. They said, he's the guy who's really close to Obama. We're not going to deal with this Fisher Mitchell. We're going to deal with Rahm Emanuel because we know he's the really important guy. And Rahm Emanuel said, no, I don't want to have a back channel with you. You have to vote for Mitchell. So I think that also created a sense of great anxiety. The other thing that happened really early on, which is really fascinating, besides the settlement freeze fight, which I could go into, but I won't right now, is Obama's Cairo speech. Obama's Cairo speech is really, really interesting. First of all, it was a great blunder that Obama did not go to Israel at that point. The problem then became that Obama quickly became so unpopular in Israel and with so little to show on the peace process that they couldn't figure out a way of getting him to Israel and having it be a good visit, right? It's not a good visit if you go to Israel, people are protesting all the time. And he quickly became unpopular in Israel. They actually thought, and the reason that he's unpopular are interesting. People like George W. Bush. The polls also show that they're quite strikingly high percentage of Israeli Jews thought Obama was a Muslim. According to one poll in 2009, 39% of Israeli Jews thought Obama was a Muslim, which is even higher than the crazy numbers in our country. But when Obama went to Cairo, they thought they were giving a very pro-Israel speech. Why? Because they feel, what are we doing? We're going to the heart of the Arab world, to Cairo, and we are going to denounce Holocaust denial. We're going to call out the Arabs for their willingness to engage in Holocaust denial. We're going to say that's an abomination, the Holocaust, and we will get real credit for that in the eyes of Jews and the Israelis. But they miscalculated in a really fascinating way. To understand Israeli psychology and Israeli politics, one of the things that Israelis generally really do not like is the linking of the Holocaust to the creation of the State of Israel. Why don't they like that? Because that's what the Palestinians and the Arabs say. The Palestinians always say, we are paying the price for the crimes that were committed by the Christians in Europe, and we're having to pay because of the Holocaust, you created a Jewish state in our backyard. So actually, if you notice the way Israeli prime ministers speak, especially Netanyahu, they always say that the justification for Israel's existence has to do with the 2,000-year-old Jewish history of connection to the land, not from the Holocaust. And so the Obama people, I think, thought they would get credit for speaking about the Holocaust. But in fact, to a lot of Israeli ears, it sounded like the Israel's creation was just payback for the Holocaust, which is to say there was no real historical foundation for a Jewish state except for the fact that Hitler had done all these terrible things. So anyway, there are other things to talk, there are other aspects to the story about why the relationship went south starting in 2009, but I'll stop here for now.
I want short declarative questions, but I can't be sure you're going to get a short declarative answer.
I'll try to do better.
I kid the speaker.
Very quickly, are you describing more 2008, 9, 10, maybe the first half of 11 than where the relationship is today? And coming off that, what do you expect Bibi to do for Romney or not to do for Romney?
I think in the summer of 2011, the relationship took a very different turn. In May 2011, Obama gave his speech talking about negotiations along the lines of the 67 lines plus swaps. If you remember, Netanyahu came to Washington very upset and said, those are indefensible lines, we won't negotiate on those terms. Now, Obama only gave that speech for two reasons. First of all, the Palestinians were going to go to the United Nations. And Obama was desperate to try to figure out a way of starting negotiations that would derail the Palestinians from going to the UN. Why? Because Obama people were afraid that America would be isolated from the UN. They would be forced to veto the Palestinian bid at the very moment that the Arab Spring was producing this tumultuous change in the Arab world, and that America's reputation would sink even lower in the Arab world at exactly the moment that we needed to try to develop a relationship with all these new leaders that were coming to power all over the Arab world. So they launched this speech to try to derail the Palestinians. It failed, in part because Netanyahu didn't accept the terms. Then Obama, once Netanyahu rejected the terms, Obama essentially threw in the towel, which is he basically said, There will be no more confrontations with the Israeli government between now and my election. And something very interesting started to happen actually in the summer of 2011, which is that people around the Obama campaign started polling on the Jewish vote. And they asked this question: who could we get to tell American Jews that Obama is pro-Israel? Who American Jews would believe? Right? So they were looking for surrogates. They were looking for what are known in the business as validators. And they found that if you tell American Jews that some Jewish congressman thinks Obama is great for Israel, they don't know who that Jewish congressman is and they don't particularly care. And if you tell them that some Jewish organizational official says that, it doesn't have any impact. But if you tell them that the Israeli government itself thinks that Barack Obama is very good for Israel, then that actually does move the needle. And so central to the Obama political strategy in dealing with the Jewish vote became this idea of getting the Israeli government itself to vouch for Barack Obama's pro-Israel credentials. And if you notice, you particularly look at David Axelrod, because he sends a lot of this stuff out. They started sending out a stream of pro-Obama statements by top Israeli government officials. Barack, Shimon Peres, they even got something nice out of Avigdor Lieberman. And the truth is that there was stuff to say, right? Because Obama has sold Israel better and more military technology than any previous president. He intervened very dramatically when, if you remember, when there was this mob attacking the Israeli embassy in Cairo. Obama intervened personally with the Egyptian leadership to say, they had things to say. Obama has gotten extremely tough sanctions passed against Iran. And so I think from that point, basically, the Obama people made it clear, and I think this was essentially Bill Daley, the chief of staff, and Tom Donilon, the national security advisor, decided there would be no confrontation with the Netanyahu government as much as they could avoid it, period. I think that Netanyahu is far too smart to in any way be publicly supporting Mitt Romney. Obviously, he has friends like Sheldon Adelson who are supporting Romney. But my suspicion is that although Netanyahu would clearly like Romney to win, he doesn't think Romney's going to win. I can't be sure, but I suspect that Netanyahu actually thinks that Obama will win, even if he would rather he not. And that's part of the reason he knows it would be silly for him to do it. And Netanyahu is a smart guy, understands American politics very well. I think far too smart than to do something like that, which would be so naked in showing the fact that he prefers Obama.
There is no prime minister that has been elected in Israel that has the backing of the Israelis as Netanyahu has, because not only does he speak the king's English, and not only that, but he has his graduate degree. Not only that, but he spoke to the combined Congress and delivered a speech that was held as one of the greatest speeches made to the combined Congress. You spoke a great deal about the yichus of Obama and the yichus of Netanyahu also comes to the fore. And we deal a lot with yichus tradition. Netanyahu is not the last to be heard from. The spelling bee in Israel is a national Bible contest.
Yes. Yes.
And Netanyahu's son.
That's right.
Is one of the three finalists.
That's right.
Of all of Israel.
That's right. That's
that
right.
Was came in third.
That's right.
Which means that you're not hearing the end of the Netanyahu family.
You may well be right. And actually, I think that the Netanyahu was clearly a very, very smart man. His father was a very, very distinguished scholar, as I'm sure you know, of the Spanish Inquisition. I think that actually the tradition of the scholarship in Tanakh, in Hebrew Bible, actually comes from his wife's family, the Netanyahu's brother-in-law, that they have some kind of Bible scholars on the Ben Artsy side, which is Netanyahu's wife. You're right. Netanyahu speaks terrific English. I mean, he went to high school in the United States. His first marriage took place in the United States. His first job was in the United States. He went to college and graduate school in the United States. Many of his uncles live in the United States. The whole wing of the Netanyahu family that lives in the United States. In fact, there's a great story about when he got elected first, his first prime ministership in 1996. They interviewed his father, Ben Sion, and they said, you know, your son's prime minister, what do you think? And Ben Sion, he says, his Hebrew is improving. And I think there's no question that part of Netanyahu's mastery, political mastery, has been the fact that he is so fluent in both the American and the Israeli political scene. Some of his top advisors in Israel, like Ron Dermer, are themselves also American-born, and it's been reported that the language of what they call the fish tank, which is the kind of like the inner sanctum of the prime minister's office, is actually English. The lingua franca is English. And so I think that's, you know, if you compare that to people like Yitzhak Shamir, for instance, you know, you see how much of an asset this is. And also remember, Netanyahu made his name as Israel's ambassador to the UN when he was going on Nightline. He used to go on Nightline all the time in Rome. He became very close to Ted Koppel. And in essentially speaking, in the world of public relations, making Israel's case to an English-speaking audience. And he is very, very good at that. And I think it is, regardless of whether you agree with him or not, I think it served him very well.
Could you please comment on Edward Klein's book, The Amateur? There's many parts that you could comment on, but maybe let's address his belief and his premise and the miscalculation of Obama having to do with the push for the settlement issue.
The settlement issue. I think to understand the context of the settlement issue, I think the first thing you have to understand is that Abbas and Olmert were engaged in quite serious negotiations in late 2008 as Olmert was becoming a lame duck because of his own political problems. I think the first preference of the Obama administration would have been for those negotiations to continue, because both Abbas and Olmert have said subsequently that they felt that the negotiations were actually really getting somewhere. Netanyahu saw his election in part as a repudiation of Olmert's negotiations and refused to continue those negotiations. In fact, it's important to remember that when Netanyahu was elected in early 2009, he was not on record as supporting a Palestinian state. He did not say, I support a Palestinian state, until the speech at Bar-Ilan in the summer of 2009. So for the Obama people, this was partly a conundrum, which is to say, Netanyahu won't continue these negotiations. He won't even say that he's negotiating in pursuit of a Palestinian state at all. So what do we do? The other problem that they faced from their perspective was they believed that the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank, Abbas and Fayyad, was doing what they had promised to do under the roadmap. Which, remember, the deal in the roadmap essentially was the Palestinians have to do much better security cooperation. Israel is going to have a halt on settlement growth. The Palestinians said in the West Bank, Abbas and Fayyad said, hey, a second, we're doing a good job. The Israeli generals are saying we're going to, we've locked up a lot of Hamas guys here at some political cost to us. So, hey, the Israelis have not done their part. They have not either dismantled illegal outposts or done a settlement freeze. And in addition, it's important to remember what happens right before Barack Obama comes into office. Operation Cast Lead, the war, Israel's war in Gaza. That war is politically really a big problem for the leadership in the West Bank. Why? Because Palestinians are furious at Abbas and Fayyad for sitting back while Israel fights against Hamas. In fact, many Palestinians suspect, and they might be right, that Abbas and Fayyad are secretly cheering the Israelis on. So Abbas is not a democratically elected leader anymore. His mandate has run out. Fayyad has never been popular amongst the Palestinians. He has very little political base. He's considered to be essentially, and I think the man's a very admirable guy, but he's considered amongst many Palestinians to be a puppet of the West. His security forces, which are trained by the United States, are generally considered to be very oppressive by Palestinians in the West Bank. And so the Obama people think, wait a second, we've got to do something to boost these guys, Abbas and Fayyad, or else they're going to go the way of the dodo bird, and we're going to have Hamas in the West Bank too. And what are they demanding? They're demanding that Israel live up to its roadmap obligations of a settlement freeze. So they say, okay, we will ask for a settlement freeze And then we're going to ask the Arab countries to also take steps towards diplomatic normalization with Israel, and that will create a kind of atmosphere in which negotiations can start. The Netanyahu people say, are you crazy? A settlement truce, including Jerusalem? Even the more left-leaning Israeli prime ministers, like Rabin and Barak, never did this. You think that we, even if we wanted to, could do a settlement truce which included the large, what they call settlement blocks, and also Jerusalem? That's so crazy that the only explanation we can come up with is you're trying to bring down our government again. You're basically forcing us, if we go ahead with it, our right-wing partners will bolt, and you're basically trying to create a coalition because you really want to bring back Tzipi Livni. So I think that's the dynamic. I think the settlement freeze, I think if you talk to the Obama people in private, they never really expected it would apply to Jerusalem. But they didn't say that in public because they couldn't say that because the Palestinians were very adamant that it also applied to East Jerusalem. The Palestinians are frankly in many ways more worried about East Jerusalem than they are about almost anything else because they feel that essentially East Jerusalem is being ringed by Israeli settlements that make any access between the rest of the West Bank and East Jerusalem very, very difficult. And because Netanyahu has a history of building new Jewish neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, Har Homa in the 1990s and now more recently this new one, Gibeit HaMashiach. So the settlement freeze ultimately produced an enormous amount of conflict and back and forth. Ultimately, what you got was this 10-month partial settlement freeze that didn't really accomplish very much. First of all, it didn't accomplish very much because there was an exception for building upon foundations that had already been laid, which is to say, if the foundation of a building had already been laid, if you'd started building, you could continue building. And during the months before the negotiations, this was widely covered in the Israeli press, the settlers basically built the foundations of many, many, many new buildings, knowing that they could continue to build on them through the settlement freeze process. And then once the settlement freeze expired, they started doing new buildings. So that's why, according to Peace Now's calculations, there was actually more building in 2010, which was the freeze year, than there had been in 2008. The other thing is that the negotiations that took place didn't really go anywhere. Between the Palestinians and Israel. Now, why they didn't go anywhere is partly, I think, because the Netanyahu government was simply not interested in negotiating in anywhere near the same parameters as Olmert was, and Abbas didn't want to be negotiating at all unless he felt like they were going to have, unless it was going to be in the same ballpark as he had been negotiating with Olmert, because given how politically weak he was, he felt that every time he got into a room with Benjamin Netanyahu, his popularity diminished. And so he didn't want to be in negotiation with Netanyahu unless he saw some tangible evidence that Netanyahu was negotiating along the same parameters. And they never saw any evidence that Netanyahu, the Israelis never put any maps on the table at all. The Israelis were not willing to talk about borders. And that was basically why the settlement freeze ultimately came to nothing. In retrospect, it's true. It looks like a big political cost, which hurt Obama's reputation in Israel, and didn't accomplish anything. But I think you also have to ask the question, what would have been the alternative? If Obama hadn't been pressuring Netanyahu in the first half of 2009, I don't think Netanyahu would have ever said he was for a Palestinian state at all. Because remember, much of this political coalition is not for a Palestinian state. The Likud party platform today is explicitly opposed to a Palestinian state, and that's Netanyahu's base. So I don't think Netanyahu, of his own accord, would have moved in that direction, probably.
Before we take the last question, our sponsor. I just want to remind you, please, thank you again for coming. Remind you to clean up, please. And there's some water here. And now, Peter's got to get a plan. Also, remember, his books are in the bookstore. So, this is Everett.
First of all, it is outstanding. Really, it's great. Mother tongue, Imircha Hashem, next year you come back in a larger larger venue so even more people can hear you. My question is, how do you explain the enormous support for Bibi in Israel?
I think there are several reasons. First of all, things in Israel are good. If any of you have been there recently, there is still the threat of rocket fire from the south, which you really feel in the southern cities like Ashdod, Ashkelon, and further south in Sderot. There hasn't been that much of it since 2009, since Casper. There have been very, very, virtually no suicide bombings, thank God. And so the life, especially in the greater Tel Aviv area, which is where most Israelis live, but all over Israel, is much more relaxed. Conditions are much better than they were during the terrible years of the Second Intifada between 2000 and 2004, or even during the peace process years of the 1990s when Hamas and Islamic Jihad and even Fatah were doing these terrible, terrible suicide bombings. So Netanyahu has brought not peace, but remember, most Israelis probably don't think peace is possible. He's brought at least normalcy, some feeling of normalcy, being about to go about your daily business. Israel is also prospering. Now, it's not prospering in a very equal way. So, and Israel is still a country, much more than us, that has a socialistic tradition, and that the Israeli middle class is getting very squeezed, which is why you saw these huge protests last year and then again this year. But still, on aggregate, Israel has survived the financial crisis really quite well, partly as a result of their very, very gifted central bank head, Stanley Fisher. But I think Netanyahu gets some of the credit for that as well. The other reason is that the left, two other reasons. First of all, the right in Israel has benefited from demographic change, which is to say the groups that are growing in Israeli society are the religious, who tend to vote for the right, and the Russians, who came in vast numbers in the 1990s and also vote to the right. So the demographic constituency of the Israeli electorate has changed in some significant ways since the early 1990s, when Meretz, the furthest left Jewish party, I can't remember how many seats they had, like 20 seats, now they have 3 or something like that. Partly the Meretz voters, who are secular, Ashkenazi, native-born Israelis, are simply a smaller percentage of the population. But the other reason is that the Israeli left has never recovered from the Second Intifada. The narrative, which is very, very, very strong in Israel, is we gave them a wonderfully generous offer in 2000 at Camp David, and what did they respond with? With suicide bombing. Then we gave them Gaza, and what did they respond with? They responded with rocket fire. So you see, they don't want a Palestinian state. They just want to destroy us. And the thing that made that argument so deadly to the left was that the first Intifada argument, the second Intifada argument, was that it was endorsed by Ehud Barak himself. When Ehud Barak came back from Camp David, and remember, then had to run against Ariel Sharon, who was right, in February 2001, he said, "I exposed Arafat. I gave Arafat a good deal, and I showed Arafat who he really was." So Ehud Barak himself, as the leader of the center-left of Israel, said, "I tried it and it didn't work." Very, very interestingly, actually, and I have some of this evidence in my book, in more recent years, some of Barak's top aides have now come out and said, you know what, that was not entirely correct. That the narrative that we sold to the Israelis, we set out in 2001 in an effort to defeat Sharon, which failed, wasn't actually true to the reality of what happened in the negotiation. That yes, Arafat was totally not up to the task in many important ways, but that actually there were very serious negotiations with the Palestinians that took place. There were Palestinian offers that were made, and that the narrative that Barak went out and told everybody in 2001 is not actually true to life. And one of the things that's so complicated, and I go through some of this evidence in my book about what really happened at Camp David, then with the Clinton parameters in December 2000, and then at Taba, because remember, they were still negotiating virtually right up to that election with Sharon, and the two, is that the Israelis, the American negotiators, have differing views about what happened. Dennis Ross's account does not match up with the account of some of the other American negotiators, Martin Indyk, Rob Malley, and Aaron Miller. And the Israelis themselves have competing accounts. So if you ask the question, the very central question, was there any reason to believe that at in the negotiations of 2001, the Palestinians would make substantial concessions on the right of refugee return, which I think is probably the single biggest obstacle on their side to a deal. One key negotiator, Don Meridor, says they were dead set on not giving an inch on right of return. Two other negotiators, Gilad Shear and Yossi Beilin, said, no, I believe that basically they would have settled for something more like a symbolic return. It's an amazing thing. It's like a Rorschach test, what happened there. Everyone sees it in different things. But the regardless of the reality, the political reality was very, very much in Israel, accepted by the Labor Party as well as Likud, which was basically, we tried and there's no partner. And so that plays much, much more into the hands of the Israeli right. And I think that's another big part of the reason that Netanyahu commands so much political support. And if you look at the Labor Party today, the Labor Party's leader, Shelly Yakimovich, doesn't talk about the peace process in Palestinians at all. I mean, she's purely attacking Netanyahu on his economic policy. She's essentially given up on the idea that the Labor Party should have any profile on the question of Middle East peace at all, which is really, really quite remarkable.
Peter Meyer, please come back to the topic.
And they're not going to unless, until, God forbid,